Professor Brené Brown's research shows that vulnerability fosters good emotional and mental health. It is a sign of courage. We become more resilient and brave when we embrace who we truly are and what we are feeling. The Vulnerable Scientist Podcast is a space for scientists to tell their honest and authentic stories. I am your host, Sarah Nyakeri, who happens to be a scientist, informal science communicator, and I help scientists create personal websites. If you want to support this show, go to www.patreon.com/thevulnerablescientist. You can also follow this podcast on all social media platforms at TV Scientist Pod. Can we talk about that? The need to support a woman who wants to, because this was her opportunity to get her a PhD. Can you talk about you as a man supporting that? Yeah.
I think, disclaimer. Mm-hmm. First, it can work for you or against you.
Mm-hmm.
Because before then, I was in a relationship. When I was leaving for my master's. And so that went terribly wrong because my other half at that time was not willing to leave Kenya. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I'm also willing to come back. But then because of that long distance thing, it didn't really work well. But for this, I guess, as I said, it can backfire, but then it can also work for you. But I'm also of the opinion that you don't need to hold somebody down just for you to get what you want. You know, well, you can't be having a relationship if your partner is grumpy, you know.
Yeah,
They have to follow their dreams. In the end, I do say it's like going to the gym. Mm. You know, it's your personal growth. And if you can't grow and be satisfied with yourself, then you basically have nothing to offer. So you are empty and you're expected to give much back. So I normally say when it comes to career, and I mean, ladies get so many pitfalls more than men. Mm-hmm. I mean, you take a break to take care of children, or you take a break for maternity. You know, you take a break to go when your child falls from the swing. You know, mm-hmm. It's most of the time it's the lady that is making this sacrifice, and I guess also even God will not reward you if it's just your career that is just taking a rocket exit from to space, and then someone else is left behind.
Yeah. I love that.
Anyway, so in that aspect, I think I chose. And it was a conscious decision that wherever she had an opportunity, I was going there. And I was going there after 1 year. Mm-hmm. And you ask me why 1 year? Because both of us had to find a footing. She had to go down there to the University of Adelaide and see if it's something that she was going to do. And I had to set our finances in order, you know.
There's something I've realized, like, for you, it's important for you to see that the place that you're going is conducive for you. It's not like if you get an opportunity, you jump and you say, I'm going to hold on to this opportunity because it's the only thing that I can get. For you, it's like, is this good for me? Yes, it's a good opportunity, but is it good for me? As in, I like that you question that.
Yeah, I mean, even in my current place, I remember, and I didn't leave the previous place in the best of terms, in terms of like that's where I was experiencing most of the things that I didn't agree with. Mm-hmm. And so I remember this one day, they come and they say, oh yeah, we are going to restructure a few things here, and I think we can make your position with us a bit more, you know, with more leadership and all that. And then when they finished saying that, and I'm like, I'm sorry, but I wasn't planning on renewing my contract. And then you could see that the moods change and everything. But then at least I was clear. I'm like, I'm not renewing, but I also don't know where I'm going next.
Wow, like you just leave things not knowing. Like, you know, for us, most people would maybe hate their jobs, or they would maybe hate even the relationships. And they would like hang on to it, just waiting for another opportunity so that they don't have that gap where they don't know where they are. Like, they feel like they need to be somewhere. And I would understand that. But for you, you like, I'm done. And you're not sure where you're going next, but you're done. And somehow,
yeah, you're done because you completed. You're not leaving your duties halfway through or undone. You put in your 100% to the last day. It's your job in the end. But you already know that you're not going to renew that contract. So you've made peace with it. So in most of these scenarios, I've already made my peace. And if there are two or more people in that place that I trust, they already know. Yeah, so even when you're doing your last day of work, you just say, hey, if you are planning to do something for my send-off, please don't. I'm really, really just want to get finished with this and that. And there are things you will take a stand, and then you're like, I will not do this. But then sometimes it will be wrong if you left with your contract halfway, you know. Then they have to start interviewing and all that. So that's why you have the first 6 or so months to decide. Because the probation, people think probation is for your employer only. It's also for you as an employee.
I love that you said that. That's a very... I love that you're bringing this into this show. We don't talk about the importance of seeing yourself as a valuable thing in an employer-employee kind of relationship. We see the employer as the most important part of that. We don't see ourselves as valuable. And even in making decisions, we fear them, and we kind of stay in very toxic places. Or I don't know.
Yeah, so when you're given that contract and you're signing, if you read it carefully, it says this is the time when you evaluate whether you're comfortable with your position there.
Yeah.
And for your employer, it's the time they evaluate whether you can do what you promised that you will do.
Yeah. That's an important message. So is that... So you've gotten this position. That's another high, the high that you're talking about, where
how the whole process went in terms of like you already set your 1 year boundary, and you've told these guys, you're like, yeah, I know your position is heaven, but 1 year I'm out. I have a life to build somewhere else. And so when you were giving these promises, you already knew that you were going under your partner's visa and work your way out of that. But then there is this opportunity that you kind of, it's like it just falls there. So there's a friend who sees an opportunity, tells you, hey, look at this, and then you decide to have a conversation, and then they're like, okay, we don't worry, we will put this at the director's desk and see how it goes. And then the next thing you're getting is a contract, and then they're requiring you to do all the visa things and all that, and they're taking you on a work visa, which is more suited for you as an expatriate than being under your partner, because then you will be under student visa. When you're not a student, you have restrictions on how long you can work and all that. But then now you have a visa with full working rights. Somebody is helping to move your stuff, pay for your ticket.
And relocation, whatever, I don't know what they're called.
So somebody is now taking on the burden of relocating you. This is not something that you had in mind.
Yeah.
You know, you had other plans, and then somebody is rearranging your plans in a better way, you know. So that was one of the highs as well. And the other one was when I applied for, so this is a step back during my PhD, I applied for this funding. It's called the Terry Muren Grant, and it's offered by the government of the Netherlands, one of the ministries there. And so they give you, first you get, I think, like 1,500 euros to kind of do like a pre-visit to a lab anywhere in the world where you want to be, and they're willing to have you so that you can do your research there and then work with like these experts that you've always wanted to work with and all this. So I used that pre-visit thing to go to the Sanger Institute, and I met this nice professor there. He's called Professor Stephen Bentley at the Sanger Institute. And so through this relationship, then I applied now for this grant, which was supposed to cover working and living expenses.
Sorry.
So it covered the living expenses and just to be able to work abroad for up to 1 year. So I got this Terry Muren grant, and so I'm here in the UK and just doing science in the best of places. So those are the places where you actually just, I normally say it this way, the places that just, they mold you, they're too big that you just feel small and you have room to grow, you know. So one of those places was this Sanger Institute, working with all those scientists from the Cambridge University. And I got to meet also a very interesting network of Kenyans. I think Dr. Francis Wamonje. And I met a couple of people there. I actually met, is it Samolo? Oyola. So he's at Iriri as well.
Yeah.
So I met all these people there. And I also met other Kenyans who are still working abroad. And we get to share these experiences, and they help you grow also as a scientist. Yeah. Well,
sorry.
I was the one holding it in. Anyway, so that was one of the other highs, like in this career, when you know you get that excellent opportunity, you apply for this competitive funding, and somebody just gives you $1,000,000 and they're like, yeah, go do some good science. And you're not a scientist, then you're a student.
Yeah, that's a big high, especially for scientists, especially younger, when you're younger in the field.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay,
yeah.
So another high.
Yeah, there is a lot. Mm-hmm. Yes, so, but we can dive into some specifics that you probably may want to know. But, in terms of highs, I also like, I got to go to two world-class institutions that are like more centered to bioinformatics, which was my field of interest. So that there is the Sanger Institute, and then there is the UC Santa Cruz. So those are the guys, they are famously known for the genome browser. So their genomics institute. You know, I got to work with some world-class individuals, and even just getting an opportunity to just interview and get a position with the institutions like the Imperial College London. This is like a top 10 institution in the world, you know, among the top 10 institutions. So they were working with the GSK, you know, these are all highs that, you know, you get to highlight even in a CV, and you feel good.
So you're a bioinformatician right now.
Yes.
How you mentioned something that you wanted to do bioinformatics.
I wanted to do biochemistry.
Okay.
So I wanted to do biochemistry. And so after I graduated and went through that whole working in the lab and all that, I honestly never liked it. So
this is that after was also like,
yes. So then I had options. I could either go to like medical representative. I think I interviewed for only one of those jobs. And when they told me the salary, I was like, I probably... No. I think it was 36,000 at the time, and I mean, I was into photography, and I was like, I can make that in a weekend.
Wow!
It's
okay. I didn't know it's about not that. That silly. You did photography when you were in uni.
Yes, and even beyond. Even when I was doing my masters, most of the times I could come back to Nairobi and. I think when I came from the US, and so the transition between the US, that one-way ticket, and going to the Netherlands, I did a lot of photography in between there. And the next opportunity that I got to go back to the Netherlands, I had interviewed like over the phone when I was in the US. And then I thought, oh, yeah, they probably just forgot or they found somebody. So I came back. And then one day, I think we went to cover the graduation of the KMTC, Karen. And I remember this day very well because it was raining a lot. So the graduation is over. You know the traffic that you get from graduation?
Yeah.
You know, if you recall your graduation afterwards, that traffic.
Yeah.
So, and then I received this phone call, and I'm like, who will be calling me at this hour? So I like practically forgot that I set up that meeting and all. So when I got this phone call, so I'm in the traffic, my old car, and it's raining, it's noisy. I'm like, where do I take this call? And then my brother looks at me, he's like, maybe we can go to that, I think it's Kenya Institute of something, I think Kenya Institute of Law. There is an institution in Karen in there, I think it's Institute of Law, Kenya Institute of Law. So he said, oh, yeah, you can drive there and maybe we can find a room where there are no students. So I tell this guy on the other end of the call, I'm like, yeah, can you give me 10 minutes, please? He's like, yes, I'm calling in 10 minutes.
And they can hear the chaos behind.
Yes.
In the background.
Wow. So I drove all the way to that institute. Like, I drove like a madman. Then I just stopped at the gate. And then I didn't even get an umbrella. I just went with my phone. And then the guy, the security guard is like, hey, are you okay? I'm like, is there a room in here I can use to do an interview? And then they were so gracious. They even gave me a writing pad and a pen.
Wow.
And they let me use the security cubicle to do that interview for the Netherlands.
Wow. And these guys don't know you.
They don't know me. They just trusted that I'm telling the truth. And yeah, so that you see, that's a high moment, you know. You get this, we call them the small graces. The small just generosities of life, people just being at the right place at the right time. Even those are high moments when you have this grace, you know, you have these people you don't know, people you've never met, but somehow they show you this grace. I mean, they have helped you get a job.
Yeah. And they're not gaining anything from it in any way.
No. But I think in the end, when we were leaving, I was like, yeah, we need to give them some tea. But it was not something they were expecting. It's not something that they asked. It's just the after. Yeah, because I was also from a nice gig, you know, you've covered the graduation. You're kind of loaded for the day.
Yeah,
it's a nice gig. Anyway, so back to how I went into bioinformatics. So, during this period between KU and Nairobi Pathology, so I used to communicate with Dr. Mark Wamalwa and Dr. Stephen Runo. So these are the people that actually kind of introduced me into this bioinformatics thing.
Magics.
Yes.
Okay.
So, because Mark was a trained bioinformatician, I think, from South Africa, and he had also gone through Wageningen University, so he did his master's at Wageningen. So he's the one that told me about the program, and I think also Runo kept mentioning that there is the intersect between wet lab and computational biology, and I was kind of a nerd. I didn't know it, but I was, because I used to even like put together my own computer and just mess with R and all those things. But I didn't know what to do with it because I wasn't into computer science, so I was never trained as a computer scientist. I did all these packages and stuff, but then there was this excitement, so like, whoa, so all this can come together. I can earn a living doing my biology on a computer.
And have fun.
I went in. So that's how I got in there. And yeah, that's the long, short story.
Okay, so this is a Kenyan who's moving to the West. Okay. Is it Western?
Western world. Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, just tell us more about that. How is it like?
You have the excitement, I'm leaving, I'm going abroad, and then you get there, and then things now get real. You know, you're in a class where you're almost guaranteed the oldest guy in there, unless there's someone else who came back to school after working.
Yeah.
And most of the courses you're taking, they are considered prerequisites, because some of these kids did them in undergraduate.
Yeah.
So you're probably just doing them with someone else who is transitioning to the field, or. And then maybe the next, when you go a step higher, then you're going to meet now the kids that transitioned from this within the same course from undergrad. I mean, and then the workload gets real. You know, you're told, okay, you'll be taking these courses, two courses for this period. And then you're like, oh, yeah, two, I'm good. But then you quickly realize that if you miss a single class, you may as well just call it quit. Just save yourself some time and do something else.
As in you lose a lot just from losing one
class. Yes. For missing a single class, so that's a one day of theory or practical, you lose a lot. you're missing like a whole quarter syllabus, you know. Yeah. And then you also quickly learn to, like, you get to realize that, you know, we've been spoon-fed a lot. And which is something about our graduates. I mean, we know how to do all this, like you cram and all that, but most of the time we so spoon-fed. And we've been taught to just, is it regurgitate? Kind of tuck it in, mix it up, bring it back. So we are prepared to pass exams, but not necessarily to just understand what is it that we're supposed to be doing.
And how are supposed to apply whatever you are learning in class.
Yeah, so you quickly get to get these reawakenings. And then you get the culture shock and then homesick. And then you adapt and life moves on. And then at some point you realize that you left some people behind at home. And then we tend to forget that people can't just be sitting there waiting for you. People moved on, you know.
Yeah.
You come for holiday and then you realize, oh, it's not about you. So... So you have to start following different dynamics, you know. And you also realize quickly that even those that you think have your interests, they don't. They probably because you're the one calling. If you don't call for 2 weeks, nobody will check in on you. Yeah. So.
Wait, at that time, there was WhatsApp. At that time, you were doing
your master's. No, we used to use a program called Viper. And then there was, of course, the Gmail thingy, the Google Voice. There was one of those. And then there was all the applications for voice over internet protocols, VoIP. So that there was so many means of getting to connect with people. I mean, there was Facebook and all that. But Facebook didn't have a call or video function when we were trying. It was just a chat. But so, it was still okay. So voice, you used Viper. And later on, then all these other applications came in.
Viper is a bit... Purple. I think I've used it.
Yes, sure. That one.
So you're trying to say that it was like when you move out, the connection to your where you come from is kind of cut. People.
Yes. So you know there is an assumption that we I think it's a Kenyan thing. You think like if you are friends with somebody, you are attached by the hip, you know. You kind of go, you're going through your struggles and you forget that your classmates that you left in Nairobi are also going through their struggles. They are trying to find that internship that is never coming or the, you know. And you quickly settle into this routine of expecting that when you call, you know, you will find somebody on the other side. You get to learn quickly to just live your own life. Yeah.
So it was lonely. That's what you're trying to say, right?
It is. You're lonely, but not alone because you have all this group of people that you met there.
In terms of, okay.
In terms of familiarity, you're lonely because how long does it take to create actually an actual relationship with somebody?
Yeah.
I mean, the first 10 seconds are important, but most of the time you will need to understand what they are about. They are also doing the same, understanding what you are about before you invite them to your to your doorstep, you know.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're just colleagues you meet there. At work or their classmates you meet at class. And they're Kenyans, you meet at the Kenyan party.